Today, everyone, we have Eugene. Thanks so much for coming. It was really hard to put down what Eugene is about. I mean, we're here for the obvious message. He's a victim like myself. We both lost our brother to murder and manslaughter. And Eugene's got his fingers in a lot of pies when it comes to helping a lot of people. I first come across you not long after I lost my brother. You actually had a knife crime poem and sent it to me. And hopefully I'll be able to put it up in this podcast as well, maybe at the end or anything, so people can hear that as well. Absolutely amazing. Tell us about you and your journey, man, where it all...
So my brother Michael was murdered in May 2015. In the immediate aftermath of Michael's murder, I hit the drink real bad. I'm talking to the point where at one point I was drinking 8 litres of rum a week.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was you a big drinker before all of this happened?
Not on Monday to Friday, no. I liked a bit of a binge drink at the weekend. If I didn't have the kids, you know what I mean? I've got kids now, so in my younger days, obviously go to the pub, watch the football, have a few all-day sessions with the lads, in that sense. But I never drunk during the week, really.
Did you find that you started drinking to help block out what you was truly thinking, or did you use it as an excuse? And the only reason why I say this, and it's not a negative towards you and you know, this recent addiction, because you said you didn't drink before. My sister had a drink problem, and when my brother died, she then used that as an excuse to drink more. Was this something that, like, you figured out that was a way to just drink, get off your nuts, so you didn't have to face the what was happening to you at the time?
So you think, I didn't even really feel it. I think I was in that much of a shock. So obviously we found out, and I'm not going to lie, my immediate thought was, fuck me, I need a drink. But I'll drink, and it just didn't take no effect at all. So we didn't actually feel like I was drinking.
Yeah.
Obviously, when you look back, you know, obviously the dangers I was causing myself. I was drinking till sometimes 2 in the morning, sat up watching serial murder documentaries, trying to find answers in my head as to why my brother was murdered, still getting up at 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, going to work. And I think of one day, I remember this digger driver, I've walked in front of a digger driver 3 times on site. And this digger driver eventually turned around and went, mate, if you're not careful, I'm going to fucking hit you with this. And it was like a 30-ton digger.
Yeah.
So looking back on it, clearly it was affecting me. But at that time, it didn't feel like it was having any effect.
Smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. And I was driving sometimes 3 hours to get to work.
Really?
On 2 hours sleep.
Wow. The clarity of that is just insane, isn't it? Mm. Because I think in scenarios like this, we do depend on, I want to say the obvious, deterrence to try and stop you from feeling like you're in pain, to numb you of this this deep depression that you're falling in at such a fast rate that it doesn't allow you to think capably.
Mm.
Is that even a word? A capable thought. So you just carry on and you mask it, drink. Mine was, I didn't fall into the alcohol side of things. I fell into, my addiction was, I needed to cause destruction. I needed to kill. Mm-hmm. Now I realized that luckily I didn't manage to, and, that I realized that I would have been just the same. You know, I would have been just like them. And, you know, putting yourself in the danger of alcohol, driving 3 hours, walking in front of diggers, you know, just the impact that goes on from there of, you know, if that guy ran you over and killed you, he's got to live with that. Or if you ran somebody into somebody and you killed them, you've got to live with that. Then their families have to live with it. We become no better than the people that took our brothers' lives.
No, exactly. My life kind of took a bit of a reversal. Whereas I'd work all week, and if I didn't have the kids, I would drink at the weekend. Whereas I went to drinking all week, I would stop on a Friday, have my kids the weekend. The second the kids went home to their mum, I was back drinking again.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't drink when I had the kids, but I was endangering everybody else's life, like you say, when I was drinking. And that was, it got to the point where, I'm not even sure what happened, but I had a bit of a penny dropping moment when I thought, hang on a minute, I need to think about my kids. I need to think about my mum. She's just buried one of her children. She don't deserve to be burying another child. My brother's kids ain't going to see their dad again. I can't put that on my children. So I kind of had that, and I can't point a finger on it. I know, obviously, I got a lot of support from a charity called Sound National, Support After Murder and Manslaughter. And I can't thank them enough for all they did for their support. And they're, 7 years down the line, they still support me now. But I can't put a finger on that precise moment where I thought, hang on a minute, you need to take yourself in the corner and have a bit of a word with yourself here. Your kids deserve better. Your mum deserves better. Your siblings deserve better. Your family deserves better.
And do you know what it is? It's quite amazing how, like, you can go from a cloud to pure clarity of direction of travel in it, and you don't, like you said, I don't know what made it happen, but when it happens, you just know that you have to sink yourself into that clarity fast before you end up, causing more pain, i.e. to your mum and stuff. So you lost your brother to murder. Tell us a little bit about your brother. Give us a little bit of a build up of what your brother was like. And was he your older? Was he
Yeah,
younger?
Mike's 3 years older than me. We're very, but in some respects we're chalk and cheese. In some respects we're
I know
peas in
that. I
the
know that
pod.
feeling.
We've both got the same heart. We've both got the same care and nature. I was a typical, for the sake of the words, boy's boy. Do you know what I mean? Go out, play football, get dirty. Mike was quite shy, quite withdrawn. I remember one family member giving us like 15 remote control cars. I can't remember why. Mike went, "You can have one. I'm keeping 14 because I'm going to dismantle the whole lot and try and put them back together." That was a, Mike liked that sort of. That's the kind of challenge Mike liked. He liked to sort of dismantle things and see, how to put them back together. But Mike generally, he had an absolute heart of gold. Absolute heart of gold. If, and I've said it so many times, if you was hungry and you turned up on Mike's doorstep and he had one tin of beans, he's getting out two spoons. He would never ever turn anyone away. Mike only saw people. And what I mean by that, he didn't see gender, he didn't see race, he didn't see social status. All he saw was you're a person.
Sounds like my kind of guy.
Yeah. And that was Mike. You need an ear to chew, come and chew my ear. You want a shoulder to cry on, come and cry on my shoulder. That was him. You know what I mean? And yeah, it was just one in a million, really. Well, not even one in a million, probably more
Did
than
he know
that.
you looked up to him like that?
That's one of my guilts. They're probably not.
I think I share that with you. I share that with you deeply.
Yeah. And that is something I've got to live with. We have, with all the emotions and everything we go through, all the thoughts, feelings, the erratic grieving process, guilt's always, way up here.
Yeah, I had a love-hate relationship with my brother. I'd never let him down if he ever needed me, but at the same time, jealousy was a massive form there, and it wasn't from me, it was from my brother towards me. And he, like I said in podcasts before, he always used to tell me and I say to us, it should be me where you are and you looking up to me the way that I look up to you. But I don't think he realized just how much of a big factor he was to me, that whilst he was alive, everything I did was to try and get him back on the path he once was when I did look up to him in the way that he wanted me to. I already viewed him that way. But because I was like the blue-eyed boy and he was like a little bit of the outcast, so he called himself a misfit, it was hard for him to actually see the relationship for what it was, and that was love. And again, for me also to be able to show him love, because we were geezers, we were boys. Boys don't show love, we show strength, you know? And that's really sad, because now I understand that you can show your sibling love, whether it be a boy or a girl. I only know now that it was acceptable after I can't do it.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the ways I see it is I was a sheep. I was trying to follow everyone to try and get acceptance from everyone. Mike was the sheep dog. He just overlooked and he took it in and he's like, I am what I am. He didn't care about fashion. He would wear what he wanted. He would mingle with who he wanted. One day he might talk to a guy who's got 10 grand's worth of clothing. Next day he's talking to someone that's got 5 quid clothing from Primark.
Yeah.
He just that was Mike. He didn't care about that sort of stuff. Whereas me, I was just like fucking deer in the headlights. I want to be accepted. I want to be accepted. And
Yeah.
I just think that's, look back, it's like pathetic.
Yeah.
Absolutely pathetic.
Why do you think that is, as men, that we fail to see like any of this for what it really is until we get traumatized with such a horrific, like, life-changing experience before we wake up and be like, fucking hell, I was a dickhead. You know,
Yes.
I should have grabbed you, I should have pulled you in, and I should have just said what I needed to say.
I mean, me and Mike didn't necessarily have a bad relationship. Do you know what I mean? Obviously, when you're kids, teenagers, all bloody siblings' ages argue when they're teenagers, don't they? But as we grew up, we had a bond. You know what I mean? I'm a football fan. He's not. But he'd take the time. If I say, right, I'm going down the pub to watch football, he'll come with me. Wasn't necessarily into it, but he just wanted to spend time with me.
Yeah.
So we didn't have, there was no jealousy there. There was no sort of bad blood. But at the same time, like you say, I'm a geezer, I'm not going to tell him what I
Sibling
feel.
wars.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell him I love him
Yeah.
or.
He already knows. Yeah, but like it's like, ah, well, I don't need to tell you, you know, right? Nice to hear it though, right? Just that one last time.
And it wasn't just, it was showing him that respect that I'm talking about, the way I looked up to him, the way I did. I was, in a sense, do you know what? Take back what I said just a minute ago about no jealousy. I was probably jealous of his freedom. Not him, but his freedom of choice, his freedom to behave, to be able to be himself with no inhibitions. He was mine. That's the way he was. The gentle giant. The amount of stories I've heard about my brother from people I never even knew existed since he was murdered has been mind-blowing. And again, that's a credit to Michael because he never bragged about anything.
If that's the footprint that he's left on life, he lived a good life, man. You know what I'm saying?
I had women say, do you know what? If I was in the pub drinking and I wanted, and I'm saying I'm going, your brother was telling me he's walking me home. And he didn't want to kiss. He didn't want to fumble on the doorstep. He'd walk her to the door, have a good night, and he's away.
Gentlemen.
Absolute gentleman.
So what, this gentleman, this man, I feel like I would have really liked, you know what I mean? What led this night to happen for your brother and your family? Like, tell me about, like, why would someone want to do this?
Exactly, Paul. Why would anybody want to do that to my? And this is the question that has gone over and over and over in my head. Why? Why, Michael? Why would anybody want to hurt my brother? And we don't know. All we know is that good heart of his probably opened the door to this person. He was round a friend's house. There's a few people there having a conversation, whatever, just general meet up with some mates around someone's house. The owner of the house went, sorry, I'm gonna have to kick everyone out, go and shopping. So my brother turned to this geezer and said, oh, more than welcome to come back to mine. I think Michael probably knew he was a bit troublesome. That's probably why he invited him back. But do you know what? I could have a little chat with this bloke. Might be able to, have a little chat with him, see if we can sort of see what his bother is, see if I can help him in any way, see if he wants to talk about anything. Two of them walked into my brother's home, one walked out. That's just pretty much is all we know.
Wow.
Obviously, you hear from the coroner and the evidence of how Michael's life was taken. But as to the why, Michael had no defensive wounds, which I wouldn't expect him to. All we've got is five lies, five different accounts of what happened by the perpetrator.
And are you okay to divulge that? Are you okay to go into the
Well,
five different?
he went from Michael fell over. He went from he was trying to help him up. He strangled him with the strap of a bag.
A rucksack,
No, Adidas man bags
man bag.
that you get. Yeah, he strangled him with one of them. So at one point he said he tried to pick him up with it. You don't pick somebody up with the strap of a bag around someone's neck. And the coroner said it was between 20 and 30 seconds it would have taken. You don't try and pick somebody up for 20 to 30 seconds.
So yeah, asphyxiation is quite a long thing to do, especially with a man bag. Of course, struggle too. It seems like there is just some cruel people in this world, and sometimes you try your hardest to be able to help everybody. Unfortunately for your brother, that led to him being taken from you, being taken from all of us. You know what I mean? And for what? With no understanding as to why this would have happened, because you know that your brother's not a violent person. You know he's kind, caring. How you've stated he has been in this, I believe. And the fact that was this guy just purposely going out that night? Could it have been anybody? It probably could have been anybody.
From all the stories I've heard about this guy, I don't think it could have been anyone.
Oh, really? So you
I'm
think
not
that
saying he
he picked
set
him?
out to murder my brother, but I think because my brother isn't confrontational, my brother was never going to fight back.
Easy target, you mean?
Yeah, as much as I hate to say it.
That's sad. That is a sad.
If there was a fight in a pub that was across the room and my brother had nothing to do with it, chances are he'd probably walk out. He didn't like it. He didn't like violence,
I think from what I'm getting from you with your brother, he was very pure and, taking his way from himself being in a negative environment is always a positive for him because he could always carry on with positivity. Because once you start absorbing the negativity, you then express it too. And for your brother, I think by the sounds of it, he would have established that from the very beginning. Stay away from the negative. Create the positive, and hopefully, he can help people along the way.
And even if people were negative towards him, he would try and turn it into a positive. Come out with things like, "Ah, don't worry, it's just the way they are." And they wouldn't start an argument, "Don't worry about it, it's just the way they are." And that's just the way he was.
So when this happened, what happened? Did the guy call the police? Did he just up and leave and just hope that it would go away?
Now you get like the two houses where there's a flat at the bottom and flat at the top.
Yeah.
Mike was in the top one, this lady was in the bottom one. And before even Mike moved in there, she had CCTV put round. So obviously you see this guy and my brother walk in, however long, I can't
What
remember the
was the body
exact.
language like as they went in? Have you seen this video?
Yeah, I saw it in
But
court.
did it seem like they were just two guys having a chat going into the
Yeah, you wouldn't
house?
think nothing of it. It just seemed like there's two mates walking into a property. And I can't remember the exact amount of time, but then he walks out, closes Michael's door, like nothing had happened, walked up the path. I think there was a bit of a stumble from what I remember, because I think they'd had a couple of drinks. Nothing too excessive. And then he closes the gate and walks off. And he goes and tells, I think it was six different people, I think I've just killed Michael.
Wow.
I strangled him until his legs stopped kicking.
Do you know the persona that he said this?
No. Obviously, we can only go by
It's
witness
so hard.
statements.
It's so hard to capture the emotion, the feelings, the persona that the person has just gone in and told people, six people.
And it wasn't six people together. It was he told a couple of people, told a couple of people, told a couple of people.
Did they just air it off and like, oh, go away, you're drunk,
I
or
think
did
one of
they?
them turned around. I think one of them was kind of like, nah, fuck it. He ain't. But the other one was like, well, I think we should really go and check. And I think they went and they were knocking on Michael's door and he wasn't answering. And this at this point, the lady downstairs, Chris, I think she heard banging and the police turned up and they're trying to like, this point, they're trying to really fuck it. They're worrying now. They're banging on the door. So I think there was a bit of confrontation with the police and they're trying to get their point of story across. We've been told that he's been murdered. And obviously then the police go in and find him.
What was the, do you know the time scale from when he'd of when your brother would have been pronounced dead from the asphyxiation at the beginning, not the length of time, on how when it was from when the person did it to when he left to be able to tell anyone so they could possibly come back and help him? Because you find with a lot of people that I've podcasted in my time, like when it comes to things like this, the person stays in the house for quite a while afterwards.
Don't think, well, he was arrested within 24 hours. I mean, I think the very last person he told, he tried to hide in the house. And I think he, I can't remember exactly, so don't quote me. I think he got a message from someone else or a phone call from someone else saying he's done it. So he got him out the house. And by this point, the police were looking for him. And I think he basically got him to the police
Wow.
or where the police were looking for him.
So once he'd been arrested, once the police have been there, because the people that would have been knocking on the door, the police would have automatically thought that they would have had something to do with it. You know, straight away there would have been that massive commotion of being like, "What are you doing here? What is he to you? Like, how do you find out about this?" They would have said, "This guy in the pub." The investigation would have been started straight away. The manhunt for this guy would have been out there. Did the six people come in and give full information on what this person said?
As far as I'm aware, they all give their
Statements.
statements. I think there was three or four that stood up in court. I think it was. And I think one of them was the perpetrator's girlfriend.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and she'd either just had a baby with him or she was pregnant.
It's crazy, isn't it? Whilst you're in the middle of making a life, you know, you're taking one.
Right, and in that, while you say that, Michael turned 40 on the 17th of April. He just found out he was going to be a dad again. Shortly after, he was murdered on the 30th of April. 30th of May, sorry.
Wow.
The day after my mum's birthday.
So he found out that he was going to be a dad the day after your mum's birthday, or he
No,
was murdered the
in
day
between the
after.
April and the May, obviously that's a month,
Yeah.
he found out he was going to be a dad again.
Wow.
Couldn't tell you the exact day, but in that month period.
It's just, you know, another like I find like even with my brother just found out his daughter was having his grandchild as well, you know, like literally like a week before. I'm pretty sure it was a week before. It's just crazy, like this new life is being brought in while somebody takes away the old life, like it's just the thing to do. And this new generation that's coming from our family members are not even going to be there to watch and they're never going to know who they are other than a photograph.
No, exactly.
A podcast.
Yeah. Michael Jr. was born, obviously, after Michael was murdered.
Michael Jr., yeah. Like that. I named my son Saint Dino after my brother. It was...
Well, obviously, Mike's 3 years older than me. So when I turn... Mike's birthday's the 17th of April. Mine's the 10th of April. I turned 40 on the 10th of April. And not long after that, I found out I was going to be a dad again.
Wow.
So I went through this period of time where I generally thought history was going to repeat itself. I was training to do the Three Peaks Challenge in 24 hours. And I was having nightmares of being stabbed on the top of Ben Nevis in the snow.
Really?
Yeah. And I still did it, even though I had all these nightmares. And then when it came to the February, when my boy was born, who I called Jai Michael, not only did I make it to Jai's birth of all this fear, I then had to live with the guilt of being there at my son's birth when my brother couldn't be there at his son's birth.
It's crazy how that knock-on effect really can.
The ripple effect is devastating.
It's unreal. It's unreal. So this guy, he's been arrested 24 hours after you'd found out.
Yeah.
How did you get the news?
We live just outside of Portsmouth, a place called Halen Island. Mike was actually living in Stafford, Stoke. Obviously, the message has been relayed from Stafford to Hampshire, or our local police station. They've picked on some poor, young, naive, newbie police officer and pinged him off to my mum's address on his own to give my mum the news that her son had been murdered. So he turns up on my mum's doorstep. My mum's not there, but Michael's eldest daughter is.
Oh.
So she's phoned my mum, who's at my sister's. Grandma, there's police here. Mum's come home. There's this young, say, new police lad. And no disrespect to him, but he stood there shaking like a shitting dog, not knowing what to say to me mum. Hang on, where's your senior... Why aren't there two people delivering this news?
Yeah, we had two turn up for my mum.
This is the way it should be.
Yeah.
And in the end, my mum's asking him if he wants a seat. Do you want a seat? Are you all right?
Shock, mate. Shock get you twisted in so many different ways. It's like...
It's not just the shock of it, though, Paul. It was the fact that he was so petrified of delivering this news because he's new to the job. My mum's trying to take care of him.
Yeah.
And he's going, is there anything I can do for you? Well, I was at my daughter's when my granddaughter called me. Can you go and get her? Oh, can you tell me where that is? I don't know Halen very well.
What?
Yeah. Surely everyone's got Google Maps or Apple Maps or whatever on their phone.
Well, the car would have been fitted with it as well.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? So my mum's having to direct him to my sister's, having to try to process the news that her son's been murdered.
That's absolutely insane. I remember when my mum got the news, she smashed the whole house up. She literally smashed the house up. There was two people. They still didn't know what to do with her. I don't think, for me, when I heard the news, I believed it. Because not my brother.
No, same as me. Instant denial.
Yeah, not my brother. Couldn't have happened. I sat there more like, looked at a copper, I was like, are you sure you got the right person? They went, Paul, we know you guys. You know, we've known Dean for years. We definitely. And even though they said that, I'm still like... Yeah, but are you sure? They can't take him. Not him.
That's pretty much the words that come out of my mouth. My cousin died when she was 6 of cystic fibrosis. Her birthday is the 30th of May. That's the day Mike was murdered. I had my kids that day. Normally I'll go down to the cemetery on Tasha's birthday and I'll take flowers down to the cemetery. But I had the kids. So after I took the kids home, I was going down the next day on the 31st. and the phone rang. For whatever reason, come up, no caller ID, which I found quite odd. And it wasn't linked to the stereo in the car, so I pulled over, picked up the phone, because my mum's screaming down the phone. Boo, the police are here. Mike's dead. No, not Michael. No, mum. Not Michael. Not Michael. That's all I kept saying. That's all I kept saying. No, mum. Not Michael. But it was. And at that point, didn't even know he'd been murdered. Just that he was dead. So it could have been an accident, could have been anything, you know what I mean? But even in that moment, obviously knowing my brother the way I do, no. No way. And even, like, obviously, I'll say it was in Portsmouth, Mike. Obviously, we had to travel up to Stafford to go and see Michael in the mortuary. Even when I'm stood there, this close from his body, I'm still looking for makeup. I'm looking for it to be a dummy. I'm looking for some sick, twisted bastard to come out from a curtain and go, eh, it's all a joke.
It's listen, I fully, fully relate to that because I was waiting for him to go, gotcha.
Yeah. And, you know, my sisters are giving him kisses on the forehead and obviously they're crying. And but it probably took me, I couldn't hit a while, I don't know. It seemed like hours that I was just stood there, looking, like staring, waiting, begging, wishing for it not to be true. And it was only when, I think my mum said, we need to think about leaving, that went over and kissed him. And I can still feel how ice cold his skin was. Just give him a kiss on the forehead. I can still picture, I can still vision how he looked right now as we're sitting there. This ain't true. This ain't true.
I kissed my brother on the forehead. I thought he was going to be rock hard. I didn't prepare for the cold. I didn't prepare for that at all.
No, I didn't.
I didn't know what to think, to be honest with you. It was only then that I realised that he was actually dead. It was how cold he was.
Mm-hmm.
And then to try and stay focused, to try and help out mum, sisters that were also doing the same things as what you was doing, your sisters were doing. It's really hard.
Mm.
So hard, in fact, it still plays with you today, right?
Mm.
It's really strange because I spoke to mums. I've spoke to so many people, but this is the first time I've spoke to a brother on camera who's lost a brother. It's hard. Really hard. Because I feel like you went through the same feelings as I did. And I thought I was alone.
That's one of the hardest feelings, is feeling that alone.
Yeah. So, from this, was your brother buried or cremated?
He was cremated, then buried.
Yeah.
He was cremated, and then his ashes were interred into my nan and granddad's grave. My mum's nice. Granddad. Because Nan's was Michael's happiest place when he was like a little boy. That was always happy, you know, that was always his happy place. And that's what mum wanted, and obviously respect that.
It's really hard when you lose a brother to murder, or you lose a child to a crime, because they don't give you them back. like you would do if you was dying from natural causes. They show you, then they take them away again and do the criminal side of things. Then they show you again, then they take them away and do a second one because it's going to the superior courts or the high courts. And you just think to yourself, just fucking give me him back so I can lay him to rest. You can't do this to him no more. Last place that I know my brother wanted to be after he died is in a police station for 3 4 months still, like in a criminal the police morgue. I know that he would not have wanted to have been there. So that would have been, I know if he was looking down, that would have been a real slap in the face for him. I'm done now. You still put me in prison. I'm still getting sentenced, But that whole, I don't know whether it was the same for you, but being able to go back and see, then put him back in the fridge, then come back and you can go and see him again, and then you put him back in the, but each time he just looks so different every single time.
Looks like because of the distance, obviously we spend that time in Stafford. We went to see Michael in the mortuary. We went to his home and laid flowers and had a drink. And but there had to be a point where we had to come back. So it wasn't to and fro. But he was transported from Stafford to the funeral directors in Portsmouth. And mum being the mum she is, she'd done everything in her power to protect us as even at the age we are, protect us as much as she could to try and relieve. She took so much on board herself and kept it to herself because she didn't want to add any additional sort of heartbreak and pain to us kids. So mum kind of dealt a lot of it on her own, a lot of it on her own. Some of the stuff she's opened up and told us since. And I can sit here and go, oh, I wish you'd told me. But I get why she did it, I get why there's certain elements she kept to herself and not just to protect us, but because simply it was, that's my boy. That was my firstborn, So Mike, mum brought Michael into the world. Mum was going to see Michael out of it to the best of her, to the best of a mother's ability. So, yeah, we can sit here and go, oh, I wish you'd told me. I could have done this, I could have done that. But the truth is, could I at that time, could I have done it? Could I have intruded on what mum wanted? So I get what she did. So, yeah, Michael was up in Stafford. Then he come, mum sorted all the arrangements out for Michael to come to the funeral, obviously, funeral directors. But we could go and see him there once he was there. And the funeral director, bless him, was amazing. Never dealt with a murder in his life, ever. So he put Michael in a separate room. Obviously, the top half of the coffin was open. And it was like, you want to come in? You want to spend time with Michael? All the time we're open, just give us a bit of notice. And he let us spend any time we wanted with him. So I'd go in there, take a little speaker with me, put on some of Michael's music, and just sit there and talk to him. So that, in the whole process, for the better choice of words, was nice. That I could have that time with Michael's music, just gentle in the background, and just sit there and talk to him. But again, it's what mum sorted all that out.
When you are in the room and your brother is there, especially your big brother, and he's laying there, can't do nothing, helpless, and you've got all the why, the what ifs. There is that moment of closeness that you have with him that you never had before. The silence of no words, no arguments, just that silence of you both know how much you meant to each other.
That's exactly it. That's exactly right. Because there was times I would sat there 20 minutes, not a word. But there was times I would sat there for 5 minutes and said 100 words. And you did, you're exactly right what you say. It's just that closeness, just next to each other, no words needed, No arguments, no disagreements. But there's that, you feel that closeness.
Yeah.
There's two times that I felt closer to Michael than ever. Once was in that room, and once was on top of Ben Nevis. And I still cannot quite put into words when I was at the top of Ben Nevis, but I told you about all the nightmares. That's probably the closest I've ever felt to Michael since he was murdered.
We done Ben Nevis for my brother as well. It's just so surreal, like how much your story links to my story. Do you know what I mean? It's really hard to put in there, because for me, I felt like I felt that on my own. Like no one could feel like this. No one could feel the way that I feel.
It's one of the reasons I wanted this podcast so much. Not because I knew we was gonna necessarily have those links, but from one brother to another, who's pretty much gone through the same.
What happened with the guy? Did you have a trial with him?
Yeah, 4 days.
4 days, yeah?
4 days, and it took
Inconclusive.
65 minutes to come back with a unanimous decision.
Yeah.
It was that quick, we actually thought he got away with it. Because by the time we left the courtroom and we got taken down into this private room we was in, and it was like, I think mum or me, or one of us was laying on the sofa. I can't remember if it was me or my mum actually. Someone said, "Oh, somebody want a cup of tea?" And the kettle was put on. And the next minute, the flow's come in. You need to get back up in the courtroom now. So didn't even feel like 60. Didn't even
Yeah.
feel like half an hour.
Did what evidence did they have to make sure that it was pinned to him that it was him? Because he obviously didn't want to admit. Oh no, he did admit that something had happened, but not murder.
Yeah. Obviously, like I said, there was only two of them went in and one come out. DNA evidence, his obviously his account of what happened. So it was pretty, even his defence barrister didn't even really deny he did it, but he was trying to talk about his state of mind when he did it. So they were trying to take that angle, even though there was, I think it was something like a 3 month full of psych evaluation on him to see if there was anything wrong with him. And it was like, no, there's nothing wrong with him. He's just a horrible bastard, basically. So his defence didn't have any defence.
Did this person have family that attended?
Mum, Nan and auntie and a brother.
What were they like towards you as a
Didn't even look
family?
in our direction. And his brother didn't even sit next to his own family. It was kind of like he was ashamed. He sat away from them.
Did they say anything to you? Not sorry or nothing?
No, nothing.
Wow.
Nothing.
How long did he get?
18 years minimum. And the judge said he won't even be accountable for accepted for parole in 18 years if he doesn't give an accurate account of what happened.
You got a good sentence there for a manslaughter charge.
It's murder, not
Oh,
manslaughter.
you got murdered, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So
I
it
was
was
going
a
to say that was.
15 year tariff plus an additional 3 years.
Yeah, when they done my brothers, they done straight 18 before you can apply for parole. And I wish they would have said you wouldn't be allowed unless you gave the answer. I wish they would have said that, because don't fully know why, just like you don't fully know why. And that is fucking emptiness. Reason. Why? For what reason? Like, there is no reason that you could possibly justify murder. But surely you had a reason for why you did it. Surely you own the responsibility to be able to tell me, us as a family, why you chose that was your option.
I've got a 16-year-old son that wants to go and see him in prison. He wants that answer. He was 10 when I had to give him that news. I had to sit him down and know him full well what I was about to tell him was going to destroy his life. He went from being academically able, fantastic footballer to completely going off the rails. Didn't want to know at school. Didn't want to play football anymore. Got all these questions. Why dad? Why dad? Why dad? Why dad? Why Michael dad? So that is just fueling my fire. Don't get me wrong, he's doing well now. He's got back into football, he's doing well at school, he's getting there, do you know what I mean? But he's still up until probably a year ago, I want to see him in prison. Want to go and see him, I want to ask him, I want to know why he did what he did, Dad. And I'll tell you what, Dad, if he even smirks at me, I'm going to launch him across that fucking table.
They have all that closed because I thought to myself that that would be a way of me being able to get them, seeing them face to face. But they stick you behind a, they still protect them, don't they? They stick them behind a glass screen so you can't get to them. You can't physically touch them.
Try and explain that to a broken-hearted 14-year-old.
Trying to explain that to anyone of any age that they want to f the reason. But for him to be able to go through that at such a young age and then at 16 be affecting him the way it has, you can only imagine without support what he'd end up going through or doing to himself or others out of anger and not realizing, you know, getting lost in that moment is it, you get lost. I'm glad he's got you there to help him. Because you have a wider understanding of how to think more so in a way where you're helping rather than creating the negative. And for your son, that is a massive, massive plus to have you in his life to be able to do that, even though you want the same answers he wants. For you to be able to be there to guide him will stop your son from turning into the person who he's trying to get answers from. Because it's so gone.
Well, he's recently passed trials to go and play football in America.
That's brilliant.
So he's, you know, it's not perfect. His life isn't a fairy tale now. He's still got his questions. He still wants answers. But he's got back to the point where he can channel his emotions in the right way, and that's through football. And that's what helps him. So, and
Yeah.
obviously, me and his mother support him the best way we can, well, and the rest of my family do.
Yeah, that's good.
Right.
That is really, who's supporting you?
Charity called Sam National.
Yeah, you said that.
Yeah, support after murder and manslaughter. I get a lot of support from them. Obviously, I get support from my mum as well and my partner. My partner, bless her.
They go through it, don't they?
That they do, mate. That they do, because I don't. My head never stops. I always have to be on the go. I'm always coming up with something that I want to do to raise money for, and it's not always, like I say, I've raised money for Sam National, but I've raised money for a lot of other charities as well.
Yeah, you do a lot. That's why it was hard on how to introduce you into the podcast because I stumbled across you for a knife crime poem, you know, and you do things for so many different people, don't you?
When I've done the first charity, when I, like I said, I got that moment where it was like, right, I need to do better by my mum. I need to do better by my kids. I got engaged with Sam National a lot more, and I was like, got phone support from them. So it's like, right, two things. I want to give back to this charity, but first and foremost, I want to keep my brother's memory alive. What can I do? My brother's name's Michael. The only thing I could think of that rhymed with Michael was cycle. So it's like, right, okay, cycle for Michael. What am I going to do? Well, this charity run a retreat 3 times a year, all expense paid retreat for their members. That's how well they look after you. Do you know what I mean? It's fantastic. It's very therapeutic what they do. Well, I live in Portsmouth. The retreat's in Crewe. It's just 200 miles. So I thought, right, I'm going to do it. Cycle for Michael. I'm going to cycle. Never cycled before.
You got on a push bike and cycled 200 miles.
I trained. Don't get me wrong. It's not like I just went to the shop and bought one. And so I looked at the dates of the retreat and I went for the last one. Thought, right, it gives me longer to train, but also it gives me longer to raise awareness, longer to raise money. So that's what I did. Trained for 11 months, 226 miles in 2 days, 135 miles the first day, 91 miles the second day. And it was good. Do you know what I mean? I was getting Michael's name out there. I was getting the charity's name out there. I think I raised like 7 grand, I think, for the charity on that one. But once it was over, I was back to the thoughts of what happened. I was back to that again. I was back to going back that down path, and I was back to drinking again. I started drinking again. So it was be, when they do something else. Mountains for Michael. What mountains can I climb? Right, there's a Three Peaks challenge. Right, I'll do that. So I did that, trained for that, raised some more money. But again, once that was after, I was back to the thoughts and back to the drinking. So now it's got to the point now, like I did, say for example, I did Snowdon by Night last year for the British Lung Foundation. Before I'd even got to the bottom of Snowdon, I'm thinking, right, what can I do next? So most people will do a challenge and they'll like have 2 months break or whatever they do and rest the body. I've not even got to the bottom of the mountain and I'm thinking, right, what can I do? What can I do next? Who can I race for next? Because what I said to you earlier, whereas Michael only saw people, that's how I want to view charity. People say that you only tend to like raise awareness and money for a charity that's affected you. Well, I want to have Michael's outlook. I want to help all the charities. Like he wanted to help everyone, I want to help all the charities. So I'll do like a variety of events for, a variety of charities. Keeps me busy, keeps me off the drink. But for the missus, it must be a nightmare. It's like, yo, what are you doing next? And do you know, she's at home, she's looking after the kids, she's grafting. Being a good mum, a good partner, and all that. So it's not easy for her either.
I can vouch for it. Not your missus, my missus. I'm raising awareness everywhere, and I'm just leaving it to her to hold down the pad. Hold down the family and make sure everything's good. I still put my part in, but I should be at home more. But I'm out trying to help spread the message, which I find is just as important.
It is important, isn't it? And if it wasn't important, we wouldn't be doing it, would we?
It's just a shame that, like, and I say this a lot, and it's a shame that we have to get to a point where we have to feel a loss to be able to make a difference, nationally. A lot of the people that I talk to now, a lot of the people that I'm associated with now, a lot of the people that I podcast or I do lives with, I involve with charities, I'm surrounded by victims. People that was left over, that's been left over to deal with the pain, that have been forgotten by the law, by the government, by society. We've been put into this cauldron of mess, and we're left to try and figure out how the hell we're going to get out of it. And I found more unity in the weakness that has been stowed upon me for me to fail, for me to break, for me to just curl up and die. I found more strength in unity with people that are broken than I did with people that are not, that people who I thought were my friends, that people who I thought had the same outlook, the same clarity, the same movement to be able to push for a positive were actually just bringing me down. And it's such a shame that I could admit guilt to myself that I was guilty of being that same person that didn't think that I would ever be a victim to anything in my life. But your brother already knew that without losing anybody. He already felt that without feeling the pain of loss. It sounds like he already had his head screwed on and was not driven in any way like how we was to be able to just put makeup on it and just fucking cover it up, do this and do that. He saw through all the bullshit.
Yeah, he did.
And it is a shame that you had to go through that loss for you to be able to see the same thing he already saw naturally.
But now, I call everything Michael's legacy, Michael's journey. Everything I do is that is it. It's for Michael. It's carrying on what, like you say, he already saw it. So now it's down to me to carry that on, carry on his perspective, carry on his mentality. I know people will probably disagree with me. I'll never be half the person my brother was. That's how I feel. And nothing anybody can say will ever change that, because that's the regard I hold him in, you know?
I know exactly what you mean.
But I will spend the rest of my life trying. I made a promise to all my family after Mike was taken. I made two promises. One to my family was that all the time I've got air in my lungs, I'll keep Michael's memory alive. Before Mike was murdered, I had a fallout with my mum, and we didn't speak for about a year. The second promise I made was at Michael's grave that I would never, ever fall out with my mum again. And that's the two that, obviously, my family and my kids, and obviously, they mean
Of
everything
course.
to me, but those two promises keep me going.
That's really nice that you say that because I had the fortune of meeting your mum today. You brought her along with you today.
Mum comes with me on everything. Do you know what I mean? She drove me to Scotland when I'd done the Three Peaks. She was my support driver when I cycled to Crewe. Do you know, when I went and done my skydive, she was there. Do you know, I went to Chelmsford to the Knife Angel to recite my poetry. She was with me. Went to the retreat at the weekend. She was with me. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of, we have those times together. There are like, obviously, when I'm at home and mum's at home, like she'll go and see my sisters. And obviously, I spend time with my sisters and my family. And, you know, so it's all quite a mixed bag. But then that's kind of like our time when I do these crazy things that I come up with.
It's good, and I'm sure. Like I believe that my brother looks down upon me, and you probably believe that too, and that he's there with you. And you know, like I think from the kind of person you've described to me, he is that. He would look at it as a positive what's happened to him that to bring you and your mum closer together. Do you feel that?
Definitely,
And it's really beautiful that you can create a new friendship with a natural love, you know, that because you know when your kids are born, whether you fall out or not, you can't not love your own child. You brought you into this world, you know, but reciprocating that is massive because you're working on a friendship that's being built through pain, and the fact that you both know what you're going through, yeah, that's a connection right there, you know, and then working on it, which is really great, you know, because you might not know, or you do know if she tells you, but you're more of a strength to her than what you possibly realize of her being able to be your support worker, doing the car runs of 200 miles and the peaks and driving to Scotland and Chelmsford, and you know, you're actually helping her a lot too, I imagine.
I hope so.
Has she ever told you?
Yeah, I don't always necessarily listen.
And that's the other thing as well, is the you know, is the listening part. Yeah, that's important. Yeah, that's
We're still
important.
men, we're still stubborn.
It's absolutely brilliant. So with Michael and his legacy, where is it taking you? Where's the next steps? What's next for you to be able to? Because Three Peaks, I was up half of the mountain, and I was like, "What? There's another two of these." Like my groins were hurting. I'd done no training. I was there. I had a pair of shorts on, a hoodie, a rain mac, and a pair of trainers, mate. I was not prepared. I had a bag with cans of Coke in it.
The sugar rush might have
Oh
helped.
mate, I had chocolate. I had everything that you shouldn't fucking climb a mountain to do.
Pretty much.
Do you know when you get up to the Three Peaks and you get to that first waterfall and you're like, wow, I'm halfway. Is it must be the top's just there. Nah, man, that was like a walk to Tesco's. That was like nothing. I was going to get myself a pot noodle by the time I got to that first one. And then you get up there, and when you're up there and you're struggling, but you know why you're doing it, so you keep pushing, you keep pushing. I actually nearly died up there. They were talking about getting me helicoptered down because obviously I struggled with my heart and stuff, and everyone said no, don't do it. But I was like, nah, fuck this legacy. It's all about the legacy. It's about keeping that. And I had my reasons for going up. And you go, how much longer, mate? They say, oh, it's just 20 minutes. So 20 minutes goes by, hour goes by, hour and a half goes by. How much longer? 20 minutes. And I was like, these fuckers have been lying to me the whole time.
You said 20 minutes 2 hours ago.
I think it was Dean that was coming down the mountain, all laughing at us, making them say that, you know. And you probably get that as well. You hear a song, you hear something, you think yourself, you just look up at the sky and you just go, you fucker. You know, but we keep pushing because the thing is, we know the pain. We know the realization of never being able to hug your big brother.
No physical pain will ever outweigh the emotional pain.
It's true.
I had something pop in the back of my knee on the first mountain, Ben Nevis, come out like a ping pong ball. And I never told anyone. I just carried on. And then I done Snowdon. And then I think it was when I got to the done Scafell Pike, and I think it was when I got to the bottom of Snowdon, and my mum was stood there in the piss and rain at the bottom, waiting for me. No fucks given. I mean, just stood there, and I pulled up my trouser leg, and there was this thing out the back of my knee.
What was it?
The night went.
Really?
Yeah. So I spoke to someone, and they said they had an idea of what they thought it was, and they said it will either stay or go. It's just one of those.
Huh.
So I'm not entirely sure it hurt.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But yeah. But like I said, physical pain will never outweigh the emotional pain, the heartache.
Yeah, and I felt the emotional side of it today. You know, our stories colliding like it has, us meeting the way that we've met through pain, you know. Having someone's life taken from you for a choice of somebody else, feeling like that's the thing that needs to be done, is something I never ever thought had occur within my life, like full stop. I just didn't ever think that we'd become victims of such a cruel way of just it's just cruel that we're now left to fight the rest of our lives. So I think we actually serve the life sentence.
We do, and I've said this to so many people. We serve a whole life sentence.
What would you do if you had the rights to the outcome, to the sentence? What would be it for you? What would, bearing in mind, think the way that you think now.
Whole life sentence. I don't want him to die. Because that's the easy way out. I'd imagine after 10, 15, maybe 20 years, he'll want to die. That's when his suffering starts. We serve a whole life sentence up here.
They say that they serve in, it's not until they get through the second half of their sentence before they realize the mistake they actually did. You know, they sit in the cell and they're this and they're that, but they say that it's for the first 5 years, they cause nothing but grief in jail to be able to state their mark that they're in there for a long time. They're fighting at the fact of anger, that why am I here? Do you know what I mean? The second half of the 10 years is you're starting to settle in a little bit more calmer. You start to realize, and then once you get to that 10, from that point to the end of the sentence is when they start turning to things like God and things like wanting to make a change, wanting to get their story out there, trying to help people understand that it was wrong and trying to say their sorries. And I don't think I'm prepared for that second half, let alone the first half. It's been 5 years since my brother's gone. It's been 4 years since they've been in jail. So I think about that a lot of whereabouts they are mentally in their head
Yeah, I do.
and what they've got inside, not inside, what they've got in there, you
inside
know.
those four walls.
Yeah, because to them, 10 ramen noodles and a pack of Coke is like they're gods, you know. You know, they've got everything they need to wheel and deal and to survive and to do their thing, and we're out here. Do you think they should have all that lot stripped from them?
I've always said, and my mum said it as well, the second you take someone's basic right to life, you should be stripped of all your human rights. End of.
Yeah.
And you should die behind bars.
If I was to be convicted for murder, that's what I would expect. No TV, just a bed.
Yeah.
Bed and a toilet. Plain toothpaste. My finger to use. I would expect that.
Their 6x4 is bigger than the coffin that our loved ones buried in. Their 6x4 is much bigger than this cell up here. Their 6x4 isn't as dark as this cell up here. We don't get day release. We don't get parole. We don't get rehabilitation. We don't get freedom. We serve a whole life sentence up here.
A good friend of mine, Michael Emmett, I don't know whether you've heard of him. I've done a podcast with him, and he's a God-abiding man. He's very powerful within his mind, and he talks to me a lot. Even still today, last week I was speaking to him. He's a very, very good man, absolutely beautiful man, and he talks to me about forgiveness. And I say to him, I don't think I can forgive. I can move forward in the memory of the legacy, but I don't think I can forgive. And he says, you need to be able to forgive to be able to be fixed, or you need to be able to forgive to be able to move forward to the holy grail of being able to help, you know. And he said, it will come in time. I don't feel like I could forgive, because I'd feel like I'd be letting my brother down if I
won't
forgive.
Ever forgive.
I was going to ask you the same thing. Is this something that you'd ever contemplated, no. forgiveness? Would Did anyone ever come to you and say this?
No. And I think they know better, to be honest. And I don't mean that in a fretful way. They just know my stance on it. I think the only person that me and probably you need to forgive is ourselves. And I'm not even ready for that yet.
I've not even thought about that yet. I've not even thought about...
How can we forgive anybody else if we can't forgive ourselves? Not that I would want to forgive
him. I think that's what he truly means. I think that's what my friend means. You need to be able to forgive yourself. I think forgiveness within is very important to be able to spread the message that we have. But if I come to terms to forgive myself for my thoughts and what I would like to happen, that maybe the legacy stops. Because I'm at the end. If you forgive yourself, you're at the end of your journey, right? A new one starts. It's no longer the fight for the legacy. It's the fight for forgiveness against the world.
I think the legacy will still continue because of love.
I didn't know what love was until I lost him.
So, and like I said, I'm not even in a position where I'm ready to forgive myself. But I think when that time comes, I will still continue because of the promise I made. And I made that promise based on love. You know, one of the things my mum said to me is, the more guilt you put on yourself, the more you take away from the bastard who did it. Which, yeah.
Never looked at it like that.
And I've taken that on board. I'm still suffer with guilt, and I think I always will, but maybe not as intense as I did before. Because it's like what Mum says. It's right.
Very much so. That's an impact statement, that, isn't it? Where do you go from here?
Me? I'm cycling from Land's End to John O'Groats this year.
And I get why you're doing it. I get why you're doing it. I pushed myself in a wheelchair from Felixstowe to here, and then from here to Woodbridge in a wheelchair. No aid, done that myself. There was a few of us that did it.
Yeah.
I couldn't even open my hands the next day.
Oh, I can
I was
imagine.
like, and I went into that as well. Got me shorts and me vest on, got me gold chain on, and I was ready to go. I did it with my daughter on my lap. Maybe my daughter on my lap. Done it with her. Pushed her whilst on my lap. But I had to do it. I had to push myself. But that's a hard one. Wheelchair. You should try it and try a wheelchair. You don't realise just how much you overlook the small, simple matters of the all paths are not flat. They're sloped. So when you're in a wheelchair, you're on one arm pushing more than you are on the other side. That when you see someone in a wheelchair, you just go, "Oh, there's someone in a wheelchair," or you just like, "Oh, don't look, they're in a wheelchair." You don't sit there and think, "Fucking hell, I should help him cross the road so he can use his other arm on his other shoulder." It is horrendous, mate. I definitely opened my eyes a lot when it comes to doing a lot of charity work in honor of the people that need it. I, my brother, your brother. The awareness is great, and I tend to carry on pushing it. And I'm glad along the way that we've met each other. You
Definitely.
reached out to us on social media. Pain brings people together, and I think it's very important that people that don't feel pain can recognize the pain and help with the matter. Because, for anyone out there that does listen to any of the podcasts that I do, the message is always pure enough and it's simple enough. Like, just don't commit crime, don't do nothing stupid, because the damage that it causes, the ripple effect is so extensive, it's actually life, soul, and heart destroying.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's one thing of always, throughout everything, it's the ripple effect. The ripple effect on the family, the ripple effect on the community, the ripple effect on the schools, the ripple effect on the police, the councillors. It's just catastrophic. It's just never ending. It's just.
Yeah. Do you reckon that if everybody had an insight to how this would feel, do you think people would still do it?
No, I think if not the insight, but the how we feel in here. If we could bottle up what we feel in here and say, "Yeah, I might take a swig of that," they wouldn't drink the whole lot. They'll take one mouthful, and I think that would be enough to. But it's putting that into words,
Yeah.
and
It's
that's the
connecting
thing.
with people, and I think the barriers that we come up against is people believing that they won't be affected by it, i.e., because of the walks of life that they are, their money would stop them from getting killed, the neighborhood that they live in would stop that from happening, but even like you say, your brother lived a very humble life in a up and down flat that belongs to a rich man that separated that house into two, and now the rich man who's never going to be affected by knife crime because he doesn't live that lifestyle, he doesn't, hang around with them sort of people. Someone has died in his flat, someone's died in his house, and now he's got to feel the negative that's going to come from that flat. No one's going to want to live there, no one's going to want to
Oh,
move in there,
no,
you know.
but this is it. It was get the stuff out of the flat. We need to get somebody else in there.
Wow.
The day after my mum found out my brother was murdered, she was in his flat clearing it out. The bloodied PPE that the paramedics wore was still on the floor. My mum had to pick that up and clear it up herself.
How did the police let you go in there without it being a crime scene and just like start wiping everything out? Because you're lucky that there weren't like evidence that would have been taken out to be able
Well,
to create the
apparently it
conviction.
was that was it. Apparently that was their all clear to go. You're allowed in there.
So they not did like break down the flat and be like, it started here, it ended up there, it
they've
was
done,
here.
they've done obviously between it happening to mum actually finding out, you're talking, what was it, 24 hours or whatever it was, to the police finding out. So in that time period, to their mum having to get to Stoke, it was all that was all done. But it just wasn't thoroughly looked at enough to think, well, hang on a minute, that could upset a parent. We better clear that up. It was just faultless. Well, you could say the paramedics, because they left it there.
But it's the whole here today, gone tomorrow scenario, isn't
Oh,
it?
yeah, very much so,
And it's like you say, the next day they wanted the flat emptied so they can then carry on with life. And I found myself hating the public when this happened, because when I lost my brother, I saw people walking down the road laughing, and I saw people sitting outside pubs, and I saw people in restaurants and holding hands and chattering. I saw someone singing in a park, you know, and I felt like walking up to them going, the fuck are you singing for? What are you laughing at? Why are you happy?
Don't you know my brother's been murdered?
Yeah. Like, and I found, like, with that, a lot of hate to society. And I only have myself to blame for that, because how the fuck are they supposed to know? How are they supposed to know? It leads us back to saying being lonely. How are they supposed to know exactly how I'm feeling? Because they didn't know him like I did. I didn't know him like I did until I lost him, and then I realised I knew him exactly how I thought I knew him.
I stood in that hotel bar in Stafford after I travelled up, stood there with tears in my eyes, ordering a pint, analysing absolutely everyone in that bar.
Did you think if someone would have looked at you wrong that you would have just exploded?
In that particular moment, no. There was other moments, yes. When I was walking down the street, and like you say, fucking awesome.
You just
What are they
find yourself
laughing
being
at?
like, look at me.
What right have they got to be happy? I'm not happy. My brother's just been fucking murdered. Why are they? What right have they got to be happy? What right have they got to celebrate Father's Day, a birthday, a Christmas? My brother's kids can't. My mum can't. I can't. So why should they?
Emotional roller coaster, isn't
Yeah,
it?
massively.
And there is, and I always find with the messages, I don't think I would ever be able to allow someone that hasn't lost someone the ability to be able to understand the pure extensiveness of the pain that's created from it. So I find myself connecting with other people that's on this positive path to create an awareness, to try and find all these zombies thinking like life is just walking up and down the path, do you know what I mean? And that's it, it's done. Like we're never going to be affected. This is never going to be a factor in our life. And I said on some podcasts before, when I've been podcasted, one of them was on the
Ben
Ben
Hatches.
Hatchett one, where the councillor woman turned around and said that it's just junkies killing junkies, and it's never going to affect us because we are we don't live in that kind of neighborhood. And then she turns around and points to just up the road here, there's some flats here, and she goes, well, they live in places like that. This is a Gov Council scheme, housing association. They live in places like that. They don't live where we live. We live in more of the upper class, and honestly, it took me so much not to just push her and under a car as it was driving past when we were standing. I just wanted to just push her and just go, well, you're affected now, ain't you? And just let the car just run over her. And
I was watching it on TV indoors. I've got obviously YouTube up on TV indoors.
yeah.
And I turned to the missus. I went, did he actually just say that?
Yeah.
And she went, yeah. I went, and that's somebody who's supposed to be running your
Regional area.
regional area.
Yeah. Save the
So,
kids. Save the pain, save the town, save themselves, mate. That's all it is about. It's all about to make sure no roadworks are happening in their area. No rubbish. Why hasn't the caretaker been round to clean up the rubbish from the park? You know, people are not picking their dog shit up. Like, that is what they worry about.
I generally thought that things would only change when it affected them. But since the two murders of two MPs, and God rest their souls, you know, it's obviously a really tragic thing, nothing's changed.
I always turn around and said, I wait and see until one of you are affected before I see you make a change. But it's a shame it's got to come to that.
I think Benjamin Franklin said, justice will not be served until those that are unaffected are as outraged as those who are.
Oh, never heard that before. It's true.
And it is. And it's exactly what you're saying there.
Wise old words fallen on new age people. How can words like that go down in history but not be absorbed by century? It's mad, isn't it?
I think Tupac Shakur's mum said, remember to keep yourself alive. There's nothing more important than that.
I didn't realise life was worth living to the extent it is. I know it's valuable, but I think you don't value it when you've got nothing to show what its worth is, right? You have children. You teach them, they move on, you get old, you die, right? That's life. It's a circle of life, right? That's what we're led to believe. But in our life, it's our job to create the footprint, like your brother. If there was someone that was hungry, he had a tin, he'd have two spoons, one tin. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, he left. You found out so much about him and he never bragged about it. People told his story. That is living. That is life. The fact that somebody else tells your story for you in a positive way, your brother lived. And what you're doing is creating the legacy to carry on. Your brother done that himself.
Mm.
Do we do it out of guilt?
Partially.
Do we do it because if we don't, they're forgotten?
Again, partially. One of our biggest fears is that our loved ones will be forgotten.
Three generations, they reckon.
There you go.
Three generations. I don't think that will ever happen for my brother. Three generations, because I'll do everything I can to make sure that that carries on through my children, my grandchildren, and everything else. It's been real powerful today, man.
Definitely, mate.
And I really appreciate you coming all this way to share this with me, brother to brother. It's been emotional.
It was always going to be.
Yeah. I know why you've done it. I know why I did it. You're the first brother I've spoken to properly. And it actually hit me harder than what I thought, mate. But it helped me too.
Good.
I appreciate you, man.
No, I appreciate you too, mate.
Is there anything else you'd like to...
Don't think so. I think that's it.
Crazy, huh?
Mm.
Boy, mate.